You are listening to Boston Public Radio. I'm Edgar B. Herwick III. It is the first Friday of the month, and that means it's going to be time now to take a trip into the skies with Kelly Beatty, who's the senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. We're going to do a little bit of an intergalactic week in review following Emily Rooney's week in review, and we're going to look ahead at what's happening in the skies throughout the month of January, maybe even a little bit beyond. Kelly, thanks for being with us again here on Boston Public Radio.
Hey, my pleasure, Edgar.
So, big news this week was a meteor shower, which peaked, I believe, last night.
Yeah, and the night before. It's called the Quadrantids. These things are named for the constellation that they appear to come from, although there's no constellation Quadrantids.
I was just about to ask.
It's an obsolete constellation up near the Big Dipper.
So they get retired constellations?
Yeah, they come, they go.
Yeah.
The pole numbers just weren't there for it. And it's one of the best meteor showers all year. Unfortunately, it's a very sharp peak. It did not favor us. Even if it hadn't been -3 degrees outside my house, I probably wouldn't have gone outside for it.
Why not?
Because I'm an aging stargazer, and you know these things. It's hard to get the blood warmed up again.
Yeah.
There is one coming down the road in August that a lot of people know about, called the Perseids. Which will be a very good meteor shower, and we'll talk about that when the time comes.
All right, that sounds good. So what exactly is a meteor? When we head into a meteor shower, or a meteor shower heads to us, what is it consisting of?
Right. I want you to picture grape nut cereal, Edgar.
Okay.
And those little nuggets.
I'm a little hungry, so picturing it very clearly.
Comets, as they pass through our solar system, release tons and tons of this stuff, about that size and larger. And when those little particles hit our atmosphere, maybe 50 to 75 miles up, they're going so fast, tens of miles per second, that they dump all of their energy into making the atmosphere hot around them as they tunnel through. And that superheated air along the route is what we see as a meteor. So that's a streak. It's a shooting star.
Yeah, but now, it's not really a star.
It's not really a star. So ordinarily, we'll see a few of these meteors every hour just on any clear, dark night. But a few times during the year, Earth crosses the orbit of a comet. Now, the comet's not there, but all the debris along its orbit is. And when those little particles pepper our atmosphere, say that fast three times, we get a shower, what's called a shower.
Okay.
Now, in the case of the Quadrantids, you might see one meteor per minute on a really good dark night. Mm. It's one of the better showers. Every once in a while, we go through a real swarm of these things, and there's one predicted for 2014 that might be good. And you might see, you know, one every few seconds.
Wow.
So there's a lot of draw. It's very dramatic when it happens. And so this is what draws people outside to look at these things.
How does the comet collect its debris? What is the debris surrounding a comet?
Yeah, a comet made, a model made famous by the late Fred Whipple at Harvard, is that a comet is a dirty snowball. It's a mix of ice and dirt particles.
Okay.
Turns out it's more like a muddy snow. It's more mud than snow.
Snow after it's been on the ground for 2 weeks
by the side of the road,
all disgusting.
And as these things come near the sun, they're normally formed far, far, far from the sun. But every once in a while, when one comes nearby, the gas heats up, the ice heats up and evaporates as gas. And it carries away with it all of these particles that are trapped in the ice. And so the particles remain even after the ice is gone, and they get scattered along the orbit like a dump truck full of sand racing around a racetrack, and the gravel is left behind, even though the comet's not there. So when we plow into one of these comet orbits, these rivers of rubble, if you want to think of it that way, we get peppered more often than usual.
Over time, will the comet disappear? Will it shed all of its debris until it's gone, or does it pick up new debris as it goes around?
You know, a lot of comets are basically extinct, but the particles remain for quite a long time. These are comets that are called periodic. That is, they're in an orbit that brings them around to the sun time after time after time. Halley's Comet is a good case in point. And so these meteor showers happen at the same time every year. The Perseids are going to happen in mid-August. The Quadrantids are going to happen in early January, just like clockwork.
That's fascinating. I'm talking with Kelly Beatty. He's senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. We're doing a bit of a intergalactic week in review and a look ahead into the skies and at the month of January. So I assume most of these particles that we're talking about, grape nut-sized particles, as you say, they come in, they heat up our atmosphere, they burn up before they ever hit the ground.
That's right.
But a few of them get through.
A few of them do get through. If an object is big enough, it's going to survive that very traumatic entry into the atmosphere and fall to the ground as a meteorite.
Okay. Meteorite.
And meteorite. And there are tens of thousands of meteorites known. Some of them you would never realize is a meteorite if you kicked it on the street. But some are very distinct. When they come through the atmosphere, they get momentarily flash heated and they create a kind of skin or fusion crust that's very dark, black, and distinctive. And so that's one good way to notice a meteorite. It just has, I ask my students at Dexter and Southfield School, what color is an apple? And they say, oh, it's red, it's green, it's red. Mm-hmm. No, it's not. An apple is white. It's just the skin that has a color.
See, this is the kind of trick question that...
Scientists. And so these meteorites have a very black, dark exterior, but when you cut them open, they reveal all kinds of secrets about the universe, about our solar system.
And there's one meteorite in particular. Now, I guess, I'm not exactly sure if this is the kind of meteorite that a comet would be carrying, but a handful of meteorites that have been identified here on planet Earth are actually little pieces of Mars, the planet Mars, which have traveled through space over time, gotten through our atmosphere and landed here in Earth.
Right. So just for clarification, every meteorite we know of came from a piece of asteroid as opposed to a comet.
Okay.
The comets are just too flaky,
too small.
Fragile. Too
the
fragile.
Great nuts never make it
they
through.
They never make it to the ground. This one is apparently from not only from the surface of Mars, but specifically from the crust of Mars. It's been analyzed for a year. It was found in 2011. In Northwest Africa, generally.
In the Sahara Desert or something like that.
In the Sahara.
Right?
The nomads, they know to look for these things. They're black rocks against the sand. They're pretty easy to spot. They pick them up. They sell them to meteorite collectors and dealers. And they end up in the hands of research scientists because they need a pedigree. So when this one ended up at University of New Mexico, they cut it open. And voila, it was really unusual. Mm. It had chunks of crystals in it that told the scientists this had to have come from a solid rock on the surface of Mars based on its chemical and isotopic composition. It really is a fingerprint that tells you where it came from. And when they did that, they realized that not only was it unusual, when they heated it up, it gave off a lot of water. Now, this is unusual. Mars does have water on it, but it doesn't often get trapped inside its surface rocks. So, even after a year of studying this thing, it's revealing all of these secrets about Mars, about the surface of Mars. Think of it as a free space mission that went to and from Mars and brought us back a sample that we can analyze. Now, it's true we don't know exactly where on Mars it came from.
Okay.
But over time, there's now more than 100 meteorites that we know of that came from Mars. Over time, we're going to build up a pretty good picture of what the surface of Mars not only is like now, but was in the past.
So how old, do we know how old this particular rock is? And how big was it? Is it big? Is it small?
It's about the size of a tennis ball. The name of it technically is Northwest Africa 7034.
But they call it Black Beauty, which is the marketing department has come forward.
It's got a beautiful fusion crust.
Yeah.
And it is 2.1 billion years old. That, last time I checked, makes it older than you or me. But from the standpoint of Martian crust, it's kind of middle-aged.
Yeah.
Because Mars itself, as is the Earth, is 4.5 billion years old. So this is a fairly late-forming rock in terms of Mars as a planet. And as such, the fact that it's got water in it suggests that something happened to bring this rock in contact with water as it was forming. Maybe it was a volcanic eruption. Maybe it was a comet slamming into the surface of Mars that caused it not only to be heated and melted, but maybe ejected into space. Because what causes these meteorites to reach Earth is something has to slam into Mars
to break it off into space.
At escape velocity, which is about 3 miles a second. And over time, it makes its way to Earth. It falls into, the Sahara Desert. Somebody picks it up and you have a sample of Mars on your hands.
Are there pieces of Earth that have been ejected from Earth that are floating out into other planets?
Yes, indeed.
Is there an exchange going on here?
There is an exchange going on. There are pieces of the moon, by the way. There are a lot of lunar meteorites. And if you were, just as an aside, if you were to find a piece of Mars or the moon as a meteorite, it's worth a fair amount of money, okay?
More than your, like $15, $1,500, $15,000
more than
bucks?
Gold or platinum.
Wow.
Could be, you know, it could be $100 a gram easily.
So we should go to the moon rock standard.
We should. And yes, this exchange is happening all the time. And so, for example, one of these days we might find a piece of Venus or a piece of Mercury. It's only a matter of time. On paper, they should be here.
Wow. Talking with Kelly Beattie, he's the senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. Speaking of Mars, this week we hit 9-year anniversary of the two Mars rovers, Opportunity and Spirit, that went up before Curiosity. Curiosity's been in the news because that landed on Mars recently, but these two landed there 9 years ago. Spirit, we sort of lost communication with Spirit 2010, 2011.
Right. It died a slow and very frigid death.
Yeah.
It got trapped in a place where it couldn't get any electrical power from the sun, which is how it does that, and it basically froze to death.
Wow. But Opportunity is still going. These things had originally like a 90-day mission or something
exactly.
like that. Nine years later, Opportunity is still doing stuff.
Still doing its thing. And, you know, where... Pity the poor scientists that have to sort of stick with this as opposed to moving
on to the next.
They
thought they were on a job for 90 days and
exactly.
9 years later.
And it is still returning amazing results. The Opportunity is about the size of a golf cart, whereas Curiosity is a much more robust, bigger, heavier, more well-instrumented rover, closer in size to a Cooper Mini.
Okay, I see.
But in tandem, they're returning amazing things. And getting back to this Mars meteorite for a second, one of the things we know is that this meteorite has a composition much closer to what Opportunity has found on the surface of Mars than it has in common with the other Mars meteorites. So it's unique.
Yeah.
And it's because we have this sort of ground truth of these rovers scurrying around on Mars and also orbiters mapping it from orbit at close range, that we can sort of get this big picture, start to make this big picture possible.
At what point were we even able to understand, like, we can analyze a meteorite or, you know, a rock and say, this composition right here is the composition of Mars?
Yeah, rocks, I mentioned this before, rocks have a kind of fingerprint associated with them. Not only the number of elements and the abundance of those elements, you know, rubidium and yttrium and things you've never heard of since high school, but also the isotopes of it. So, for example, oxygen that we breathe has three isotopes. One is oxygen-16, that's most common, but there's 17 and 18 as well. This is their atomic weight. And on Mars, that ratio is different than it is here on Earth. Earth and the Moon have the same ratio of oxygen isotopes. Mm. It's unique in the solar system as far as we know.
Yeah.
Mars is different. And the meteorites are different from all of them. So when you just look at oxygen alone, you can tell where something came from.
Wow. So Mars is one of the planets that we know of in our solar system, of which there are a handful, a little more than a handful. But big news about the number of planets that we're learning are in our galaxy and potentially the universe at large. What's happening here?
There's a spacecraft that NASA launched a few years ago called Kepler, and its job is to stare with its cameras at 145,000 stars. And it stares constantly, and every time a planet around one of those stars crosses directly in front of it, we don't see the planet, but we see a slight dip in the star's light. And astronomers can use that to say, aha, there must be a planet around that star. Now, so far, Kepler has discovered about 2,000 of these planet candidates in its search so far. What's different about this one is that this particular candidate, which is called Kepler-32,
great names that they
I know
great
they,
names
well,
they came
you
up
know,
with.
They need to have a contest.
You have to have
or
it
something.
Organized.
Is what's called an M star. Now, stars come in all kinds of shapes and masses, not shapes, but sizes and masses. And our sun is actually a dwarf star, but they're even smaller ones. These are called M dwarfs, and they are the most populous kind of star in the galaxy. About 75% of all stars are M dwarfs.
What does the M stand for something?
It's just a classification scheme. Now, let's think of it as alphabet soup.
Sure.
What Kepler discovered is that around this particular M star, there are five planets, right?
Okay.
Now, I want you to imagine taking your entire collection of DVDs and CDs that you have at home and throwing them up in the air all at once and taking a snapshot.
Okay.
A few of them are going to appear edge on to you, right? Like just a little line in the sky. Kepler can only discover planets around stars in that configuration because the planets have to go directly in front of the star.
I see.
All right. So what the astronomers did was they said, well, look, if we have five planets around this one M star in this unique configuration, there must be far more planets around far more stars than we imagined before. They're figuring one or two planets per star in the whole galaxy. There are 200 billion stars in our galaxy. Therefore, there must be 200 billion planets or more. It's pretty heady stuff, especially because it wasn't that long ago. I'm talking 30 years when we had not discovered any planets around any other stars. We thought our solar
totally
system,
unique.
We thought we were unique. The only game in town.
It seems like the history of astronomy is finding out how non-unique we are over. It's like a slow burn to realize that we are not unique at all.
To be an astronomer is to be humble.
Yeah. That's Kelly Beatty. He is the senior contributing editor for Sky and Telescope magazine. We are going over the week in star news, looking ahead at January and what's going to be happening in the sky. So planets, which we've been talking about for a bit here, will be dominating the night sky still. I mean, we think of stars that we see out there, but we also see planets, and they've been dominant for a couple months now.
Right. In the evening sky, there's one big kahuna, and that's Jupiter. It's the brightest star you'll see in the sky, but it's not really a star. As soon as it gets dark, look toward the south, that is, turn left from the sunset point, and you'll see it high in the south. It's very bright and very obvious.
Is there a color to it?
No, it'll look just sort of bright. It'll look like a star. Yeah. If you've got a small telescope or binoculars, if you got those over the holidays, say, Jupiter would be a great target.
Hmm.
But I want to call your attention to something happening in the morning before dawn on January 10th.
All right, so mark your calendars. January 10th, morning before dawn.
Before dawn.
Okay.
There'll be a very, very thin crescent moon right next to the planet Venus. It'll be spectacular. So you want to start looking around 6:15 in the morning. Most people are up by then.
Yeah.
Find a clear shot toward the eastern sky, if it's clear, obviously. Mm-hmm. They'll be so close together, you'll be able to separate them by no more than your fingertip at arm's length.
Well, is the planet going to be to the right or the left of the moon as you look at it?
The moon is going to be to the upper left of Venus. Venus is pretty obvious. You can see it now.
Yeah.
And the moon, as it's moving through its orbit, is gradually coming closer to Venus every morning. You can watch it
just
morning by morning. And then
on
the 10th, it'll be picture perfect.
All right, very nice. Anything else good kind of happening up there in the stars to be looking for throughout the month?
Not this month. Next month and the month afterward. Next month we have an asteroid coming very close by the Earth.
How close is close?
18,000 miles. Closer than a lot of communication satellites.
That is really close.
You will be hearing about this, all right?
Okay.
It's one of those funky ones. It's 2012 DA14.
Yes.
But you heard it here first. And then the month after that in March, we're looking for the possibility of being able to see a comet in the sky just after sunset.
Mm.
So stay
tuned for a comment. All right. Well, we'll talk about it as months come up. One of the things you talked about last time you were here, Kelly, we were talking about just some tips for sky gazers, you know, if you don't have a powerful telescope or whatever. And, you know, you talked about getting out into your backyard and finding a dark place. And you sort of mentioned that this is becoming increasingly difficult to do. There's an effort that's going on, I think, is it this week or next week, certainly this month, to try to get a handle on exactly how much light pollution is happening here on Earth.
Yeah, it's sad that light pollution has robbed most of us of our stars because we live in cities. So this effort is called Globe at Night, and it's globeatnight.org is where you go. It's a very simple activity that you can do by yourself or with your family, your friends, your kids, to gauge how dark your sky is as part of a worldwide citizen science effort. So you go to that website, you can download some simple charts. You need to go outside, let your eyes adjust to the darkness a little bit, look in the direction of the constellation Orion, and they'll tell you how to do that, and sort of compare what you see in the sky with what these charts are. Pick a number, right, from 1 to 6, depending on how dark your sky is. Go onto the website, log in, put down your location, what you saw, and you'll be part of tens of thousands of people who are doing this worldwide, and you can find your observation on a worldwide map get some satisfaction in knowing that not only are you part of this big effort, but you've actually taken a small but important step in understanding what light pollution is and how big a problem it's become.
What is it? I mean, I think, you know, you say light pollution. I think I have a sense of what that is, but are there implications or are there pieces of that the layperson maybe isn't quite grasping?
Light pollution is that glow in the sky that you see because you are near lights that are on at night.
Yeah.
All right. So it's where I live in Chelmsford is I look toward Boston. I see a big glow of peachy, ugly, peachy light that is just bad. And as you get closer to the city, it gets more dominant. You see fewer stars. When you have light pollution, you're robbed of, you know, the beauty of the night sky for sure. But that light that you see in the sky represents energy waste. It represents light, night street lights and security lights that are shining upward into the sky and creating a glow that's pretty obvious. We get the same with moonlight. When there's a full moon, right, we can see the sky gets bright and the ground gets bright too. So light pollution is something that's entirely human-made. It's come on strong in like the last 30 years. There's an organization called the International Dark Sky Association, darksky.org, that fights light pollution. And in fact, I'm gearing up for a battle on Beacon Hill.
Really?
In the next couple of months, we're going to be submitting a bill that would help curtail light pollution by just ensuring that when new lights are put up, that they're well-designed, that they don't waste a lot of light or electricity.
Besides not being able to see the skies, besides sort of waste, are there other sort of dangers with light pollution? Are there other things that it affects that we might not immediately consider?
Oh, for sure. A lot of ecological things are affected. You know, there are a lot of creatures in the night that do their thing at night.
Yeah.
They move, they migrate, they eat. And this glow is affecting their circadian systems. We're being affected as well. And there's a line of research that's getting more important that humans and our ability to create melatonin in our bloodstream at night when we sleep is being affected by the lights that are coming into our windows and on all night. Computer monitors and raiding the fridge at night, these all affect our ability to get the kind of restful sleep that creates this melatonin. Light pollution is part of this problem. There's a whole line of research having to do with it. But I think the biggest take-home for most people is that light at night is often a waste of electricity. That if you have a light, even in your own backyard, that's on all night, every night, a security light, for example, it might not be the most either effective means of providing security, but it's certainly a wasteful light because it's on all the time.
Yeah.
And more people are becoming aware of this. It's really becoming an area of popular, more popular interest.
Are there places where they're doing a better job, sort of battling it? Are there countries or are there states or is this something that people are battling or is it just going to continue to increasingly be a problem? I mean, you got to imagine as places like China and India develop, we're looking at a whole bunch more of this coming down the pike.
Absolutely, and there are a few countries that are just sort of as a country interested in it. Italy is very big on it, and some of the Eastern European countries. Here in the U.S., you'll find that little towns in Massachusetts, there are 37 towns that have their own outdoor lighting ordinances. A lot of them are concerned with preservation of the quality of life that they have. Cities, not so much. It's kind of like a wasteland, and we're working on that. If anybody is interested, I encourage you to go to a website for the New England Light Pollution Advisory Group. NELPAG, NELPAG.org, and you can get more information there.
All right. We'll put links on our website, and that's WGBHnews.org. Thank you, Kelly Beatty, Senior Contributing Editor for Sky and Telescope Magazine, for taking a look up into the skies with us again this month.
Hey, until next month, Edgar. Clear skies.
Thank you. And here is Callie Crossley back in Studio 3 to bring us back to Earth, Callie. Bring us back to Earth.
That's right, Edgar. It's not Friday here at Boston Public Radio if we don't look at the news that went under the radar. So today it's regional news. We'll be dropping in on New Hampshire, the Cape, and the Ocean State, also known as Rhode Island.
Love me some Rhode Island. I'm Edgar B. Herwick III.
I'm Callie Crossley. This is Boston Public Radio.